where we got to last week. We'll set the scene first of all for the week before. You remember we dealt with, they come back, they'd had a long period to build in the temple because of all the opposition. We dealt with the Samaritans and such like, where they did everything they could to stop them, but it was all in God's timing. He'd said it would be 70 years for the temple would be desolate. And at the right time, God raised up Darius, and so that they, and it gave them tremendous encouragement, and they were able to finish the temple very, very quickly. But it was dead on time, 70 years after the initial destruction. And that took us up to the end of chapter 6. And last week, I told you that between chapter 6 and chapter 7, there's a gap of 58 years. It is the silent period of Ezra. There's nothing in Ezra about what happened. But we do have a lot of information in Esther. That's why I put Esther in at that point there. So now, we're in Esther now. That's fitting in the gap in the 58 years. It gives you an idea of what was happening, and it sets the scene for when Ezra comes on in the scene in chapter 7. Now, in Esther, remember, we now have a new king there. Xerxes is now the king. Xerxes is the Greek name for him. And he had inherited the vast kingdom that his father had left him. The kingdom stretched from the Indus River, in that's the other side of Pakistan, included the whole of Pakistan, right to the borders of India on the east, and in the west it went right the way through Egypt, the whole of Egypt, and down to the south of Egypt in what we call now Sudan. In those days it was called Ethiopia, but now it's Sudan. So it was a vast empire, and he was the king of all this. Now, it took a little bit of time for him to settle himself in, and during that time, he rebuilt the city of Susa, and he set up a fortress of himself, his palace and everything, in the centre of Susa. And when it was finished, after 2 years, he decided to have a great celebration. Everything was settled now, the kingdom was settled, and so they had a great celebration there, and he invited all the chief people from all the different parts of his vast empire to come and celebrate with him. First of all, he showed them, he had a display of his vast wealth, and it was gold, silver, everything under the sun was there. He was extremely rich because from this great, with all the tributes he'd been getting from all over the nations, or all over his empire. He showed them all round, and at the end of that, he had this great feast for everybody. And remember, everything was lavish. As much drink as they want, and everything served in golden goblets. Beautiful. He was showing his tremendous wealth he had. Yes, he was displaying to them what a mighty king he was. But then at the end of the feast, during the feast, after showing them all this, he wanted also to show off his wife, because he valued her so much, she was so beautiful and everything, that he wanted to show her off. And he asked, sent for her to come so that he could show her off to everybody, with a crown on. But she refused to come. We don't know why she refused to come. Perhaps it was, I'm not going to be ordered around by anybody. It doesn't matter what it was, but in any case, it was a disastrous thing to do, because it showed him up in front of all his nobles, all the people around him. Here was this great king with all the wealth, everything you can imagine, and now he was being shown up by his wife. He couldn't even control his own wife, and he was furious about it. Yes,
common thing.
Yes, yes. But at any rate, he was furious about it. And remember, he'd been drinking quite a lot. He wasn't quite in his full mind. So he called his counsellors, all the wise people, so-called wise people, to ask him, what's he going to do about this? And they were very cunning. They gave a very clever answer, but it wasn't a very wise one, though. They suggested that he should get somebody else. He should dispose of her and get somebody else. And so he immediately, without thinking too much about it, he made an edict, a law, that would forbid her and really throw her out as his wife. Now, the law of the Medes and Persians could never be altered. It was a rule all the way through.
Yeah.
And he followed the advice of the people, and he made this law, and he couldn't back out of it.
Mm.
And then, afterwards, when he came to his senses and realized what he'd done, and now, what are you going to do about it? And so he said, so he decided to follow their advice further and get another and select another wife for himself. So they sent throughout the whole kingdom, got all the beautiful girls throughout the entire kingdom. There must have been an enormous range of them. And he was to select one of those. Now we come into the scene, we get Mordecai comes onto the scene. Mordecai, a Jew, and his beautiful cousin, Esther. I did tell you last week that in it says that they were from captives from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. But I did explain to you it was probably his father or grandfather. It couldn't possibly have been him because he would have been in his 90s at least at that age. So bear that in mind, because Esther, of course, would be quite young. At any rate, she was selected from amongst them all to appear before the king and see whether she'd be suitable as a wife for him. Now, she was a beautiful character. She was lovely in every aspect, not only beautiful in looks, but very beautiful in a character and very clever as well. And it was a foregone conclusion, really. She was the one that the king chose. She chose him as his wife.
Yes.
And you remember, as they, when he chose, they made a proclamation throughout the kingdom. They had a great feast and everything, great celebrations, holiday for everybody throughout the whole kingdom to celebrate the occasion. And Esther now was the queen. Now, one of the things she probably did then was, with her cousin Mordecai, she would she arranged with the king to have him promoted, so that he would become a kind of a judge or a magistrate, and he would sit in the king's gate, and he was very well liked by the people because he was honest, and he gave correct judgment. He didn't take bribes like most of the judges would do in those days. Now, while he was sitting there in the gate, he would get contact with all kinds of people, and he overheard that a couple of the people, the men who were set to guard, supposed to guard the life of the king, and were took guard outside his chambers where he rested, that they had planned to kill the king. And so he got the message to Esther about this. Esther told the king, and the king found out, and he took them, and probably under torture or some way, he got confessions out of them, and they were hung. And then the king, they made certain that this was all recorded, what Mordecai had done. So they record it in the annuals, in the records of the kings and everything. That was very important that should be done. We will see how it comes up later.
Mm.
Remember, I told you, in Esther, God's name is not mentioned as such directly, but we can see God behind it every step of the way. And I did tell you about the fact that it's hidden as well in there, in the form of an acrostic.
Yeah.
Four times it comes up at critical points in the story, sometimes forwards, sometimes backwards. This acrostic comes. It's the stamp of God upon this book.
Mm-hmm.
Although people at times have doubted whether it is the work of, it is fully accepted now. Right, now then the scene changes now. There's Haman. Now Haman has been promoted to be second only to the king. He wormed his way in somehow or other. He's probably a nasty character, and he's now got the authority second only to the king. And the order goes out that everybody has to bow down to him and such like. But when it comes to Mordecai refuses to do this. He won't do it. Why, we don't know. Probably because he doesn't think much of him at all. he sees right through what he's Haman is really like, and he's not going to be a hypocrite and bow down to him. Haman at first wouldn't have realized this, because the place where they met was a huge courtyard. It says the king's gate, but it's an enormous area there, and Haman passing through this wouldn't have noticed. But then some of the people, they noticed, and they brought it to his attention. And they said, well, why doesn't Mordecai bow down to you like everybody else does? And when he heard about this, he was furious. And he decided to take action. Then he found out that Mordecai was a Jew. So he thought, well, if Mordecai is like this, perhaps all the other Jews are like this. So what I'm going to do, I want to get them all destroyed. And so he went then into the king, and he told the king, he told him a pack of lies, actually.
Yeah.
He did it very cleverly, though. He went to the king. First of all, he told some truths, some half-truths, and some outright lies. And putting them all together, he convinced the king that these people were a danger to him. He told them that these people, they've got their own laws and they don't obey your laws.
Yeah.
It's true. They had their own laws which they obeyed, but they also obeyed the king's laws. They weren't like that at all.
Yeah.
But the king, being a little bit too trusting here, didn't bother to check up.
Yeah.
And so he gave Haman the authority to have them exterminated. He thought, in any case, they're probably just an alien race just somewhere in my empire. Oh, let's get rid of them. He didn't realise exactly who they were.
Yeah.
It shows his lack of understanding of who these were. All these were.
Mm.
Anyway, that's where we end up there. And then Haman sends a proclamation with the king's authority. Now he's got the thing. He's got the king's ring, so he can put his authority that all the Jews throughout the kingdom are to be exterminated. Now, before he does that, though, uses a gambling thing to find out, very superstitious, he wanted to find out a good day to do this. So he used what was called the pur, which is a kind of a gambling, we don't know exactly what it was, to find out the best date for doing it. And the date came out, and we gave the date there, which is very important there, and it's actually exactly 1 month before the Jewish Passover, the date came out. But anyway, that date was fixed, and he sent instructions throughout the kingdom that on that particular date, all the Jews, not only the men, but the women and the children, were to be exterminated. He was going to wipe them out altogether. Now, when the Jews heard about this, they were horrified at it, realised what it was, and they were in sackcloth and ashes. And incidentally, in the city of Susa, where they were, it says they all were puzzled by it, not only the Jews but the other people, because they thought so much of Mordecai. Why are they doing this to him? And so, but at any rate, the message went throughout, and they all were in sackcloth and ashes, pleading to God. It doesn't say they were pleading to God, but they were fasting, and therefore they must have been praying to God and asking for his help. Yes. And then Mordecai sent the message to Esther to tell her what was happening. At first, you didn't realise when Mordecai turned up in his sackcloth and ashes, she thought probably he had some personal tragedy. And so she said to set her clothes down to him, but he refused to have them. And at last he got the message to her exactly what was happening. And then he said to her, you must go and see the king and get this reversed somehow or other. But she said, I can't. If anybody, I haven't been to the king for a month now, I've been nowhere near him. And if I suddenly turn up, the law is anybody comes unannounced, they'll be put to death. But so Mordecai said, well, look, if you don't do this, we'll all be destroyed. But remember this, you may not do it, but there'll be another means found for doing it. In other words, God will find another way, as God always does. If we fail in doing something for God, God will always find somebody else. Remember, it's the master chess player. He's always got somebody else there. Yes, since she had to react. But she decided she would. She said, well, look, but this is what I want to do. She said, I'm going to fast and pray. Well, he says fast, but it would include praying as well, for 3 days and nights. I want you to do exactly the same. And she said, I know that if I go to the king, I'm risking my life. But she said, effectively, what's my life worth? God gave it to me.
Yes.
If it's God's will, I'm prepared to do it. Mm. Let God be in control of this.
Yeah,
and so that's what they decided to do. So they all fasted and prayed. To show that they were intent on it, the idea of fasting was not just self-abasement or anything like that. It was to show, Lord, we're really serious about this. We're not going to eat or drink. We're going to be completely occupied with you in prayer. So this is what she did. And at the end of that time, remember how she went up before the king. And you can imagine, he's only dealt with in a few verses here, but you can imagine what she must have felt like. Coming before the king, she knew her life was at stake here. There was the king sitting on his throne in the great room there, and then Esther appears at the doorway. You can imagine what must be in her heart there, or what's going to happen. But the king puts his scepter towards her and asks her to come. What's the matter, Esther? What do you want? And she comes along and she touches the end of it, showing that she was accepted. It must have been a tremendous relief to her. But then he asked her, well, what can I do for you? What do you want to do? And then she made a very strange request. She asked that they should have come and have a banquet or a feast with him. And she asked that they bring along Haman to the feast. And so this is what happened. So they went. This is the petition she asked. But it was the reason was she was following protocol, you see. You had to be very careful. You don't, in front of everybody else, she didn't want to put such a request to the king about this. You should follow it very, very carefully.
Quiet.
She was doing the correct method.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And Haman, when he realized that he was going to be the only one there, he was full of joy about this. And he came out full of, oh dear. I'm the only one that's coming to this this feast here. But as he came out, then he saw Mordecai. And he thought, oh, what, Mordecai? Here, he's not bowing down to me. Here I am. The king has given me this great honour. The queen is also there. And then there's Mordecai the Jew. He's not going to even bother to look at me. He's treating me with absolute contempt. And he was furious with him. So he decided that he was going to get rid of him. He was going to get him hung. And he says he had prepared a scaffold, a huge great scaffold to have him hung on. He'd already made his arrangements to get rid of all the Jews, but now he was going to see Mordecai and get rid of him right away. I'm not going to wait. And so that was the situation. Now we see the hand of God coming into it again. That night, Haman had decided that he was going to get to see the king the following morning and ask permission to have Mordecai hung, because you couldn't do it without the king's permission, you see. And that night, remember how the king couldn't sleep. God was at hand again, you see. And then he called for his people and he said, look, let me have a look through the history of my people, see what's happening down through the ages. Perhaps it'll make me sleep better. And as he came through there, he was led to this particular point where Mordecai had protected him from these two people who were going to murder him. And he said, well, this Mordecai, what did we give him to honour him for this? And they said, didn't give him anything at all. Oh, well, we must do something about this. And so he decided he would do something about this. So the next day, yeah, you've got the situation. You've got Haman coming along to come to before the king. First thing he's going to do, I'm going to ask the king permission to hang Mordecai. There he is. And the king is in his throne room waiting. All the people will be queuing up to come and see the king. It was a custom. And Haman, of course, would be the first one. And then the king says, how are we going to honour this man, Mordecai? And, oh, Haman's out there. Oh, bring him in. Because he was the advisor, you see. And he talks to Haman. He says, now then, Haman, what do you think we should do to the man who I want to honour? I want to give honour to. And Haman thinking, oh, this is me. No other person. And he goes through all the things. You're going to treat him great royal. You're going to take the horse that the king rode on, the robes that the king had. In other words, putting himself second only to the king and everything. And then proclaimed to all how much the king had honoured him. Oh, Haman was... And then the king turns around and says, Right. Now go and do that to Mordecai. You can imagine Haman. What? I'm going to come and ask you back.
God is good,
isn't it? It would have been lovely to be at the scene and watch it, wouldn't it?
And then, humor.
Yeah, there was Haman. Yeah, God had got a lot of humour there, hasn't he? And there, poor old Haman had to go and get Mordecai, dress him in all these clothes there, and then Haman himself has to lead the horde through the city, through the gates and everything, proclaiming to everybody that this is the man that the king has honoured. Oh dear. And Haman, at that point, he realised that the game was up. He goes back to his family and he talks to his wife and that, and they say him, look, you've had it now. your chips are up, more or less. If the king has honoured Mordecai, this you were going to hang, you're in trouble now. And as they were talking, Haman would get very nervous now, because there was going to be another banquet. The queen had asked the king again to have another banquet with where Haman would be there. And Haman would be very nervous about going. And eventually they had to send the eunuchs to more or less drag him along. What's going to happen at this banquet? Iterate. They arrive at the banquet there, they have the banquet, and they're sitting, drinking, and then at long last, the king Xerxes, he turns to the questioner and says, now what is this petition you're asking me about? He's so curious to know. All this palaver, all this is going through. It must be something very important. And then Esther tells him. She says, well, my people are all going to be killed, including myself, because we are Jews. And she must have been, you know, at this point here. There they are, he's telling them. But she said, if it was only a minor thing, if they were only going to put us into slavery, I wouldn't have bothered you. But they're going to slaughter the whole lot of us. And you can imagine Haman sitting there, suddenly realised, because he would have no idea at all that Esther was a Jew. And suddenly realising that she was a Jew herself, it must have been like a thunderstruck to him. He was absolutely terrified when he heard this coming from him. And then the king said, well, who is this? Who dare do this thing to them? And particularly to my queen. Who dare do it? And Esther just turns around and says, that vile creature Haman. And you can imagine Haman sinking further and further into his seat in absolute terror. And the king just gets up and storms out into the garden outside there. Haman, realising that the game was up and that his doom was sealed, he makes one last desperate attempt. See, what he should have done, you never stop there with the queen by herself. That was the unheard of thing. But he decides to make one last desperate plea for his life. So pleading with Esther, please save me, please. And as he does that, he falls onto the couch where she is. At the very moment, the king turns it, comes in and sees it. And said, look, you're not only traitoring to me, you're not only killing my... but you also want to violate my wife, the queen. And he was furious. So he immediately orders them to take him. They cover his head and take him out and say, go out, hang him. So Haman is taken outside and hung. They say, well, Haman had put these gallows up for Mordecai. They said, right, use the same gallows, hang him on them. Right outside Haman's house. And that's where it ends up there. But now, the story's not finished there, though. Because they've got a problem now. You see, remember, when the king made an edict, it could never be changed.
Yes.
The king couldn't change it himself. It was the law of the Medes and Persians, which must stand.
Right.
And that edict had gone throughout the whole of the empire. And so what's going to happen here? Well, first of all, the king calls Mordecai back into him. This is the first time that he would have been into the presence like this, you see. He calls him in, and first of all he says to Esther, all the goods and all the wealth and estate of Haman, I'm going to give it to you to make up for all the trouble he's caused you. And then Esther arranges for Mordecai to look after it, because she couldn't do it herself, for Mordecai. And then the king says to Mordecai, now I'm going to give you the same place that Haman had. So he gives him his ring, and he's now the second in the kingdom. See how the complete reverse now. They've got all his Haman's estate, all his wealth, and he's also got the position that Haman had. And now he's the second in the empire now. And then Esther pleads the king, look, can't we do something about this? Because all my people are going to be killed. Well, the king says, well, I can't alter the edict, but this is what we'll do. Mordecai, you're a clever Jew. I'm going to give you the authority to go and issue another edict, which will somehow or other annul the other one. It won't cancel it, but it'll somehow or other overcome what's there. And so he leaves it in the hands of Mordecai. So Mordecai very cleverly words out an edict, the edict being that they can now defend themselves, you see. And so he sends, with the king's stamp on it now, because you've got the authority now, and this goes throughout the whole empire by fast horses. You've got to act quickly now. And it goes throughout the whole kingdom. And it says, when this happened, everybody was relieved, all the Jews, of course. Well, incidentally, it also says that the edict was not only, the first edict of Haman was only given in the name, the languages of all the tribes in the empire, but not to the Jews. It was not given in Hebrew. But now it makes a point of saying this is also to be done in Hebrew, so that the Jews themselves will know firsthand. They only heard before from the others, but now it was told to them exactly what they could do, how they could rearm themselves and get ready and do, and we're going to deal with that in a minute. And there was tremendous rejoicing throughout the whole empire of the Jews, but in the city itself, the whole city rejoiced. And that's where we finished up last week, at that point. So now we come on to chapter 9, verses 1 to 4. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. Now that date, by the way, is exactly 1 month before Passover. So it would be somewhere around about March, wouldn't it? Well, it depends. Passover varies in the dates. But somewhere around about then was to be carried out. On the day the enemies of the Jews had heard to overpower them, but now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities, in all the provinces of King Xerxes, to attack those seeking their destruction. No one could stand against them, because the people of all the other nationalities were afraid of them. And all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews, because fear of Mordecai had seized them. Mordecai was prominent in the palace. His reputation spread throughout the provinces, and he became more and more powerful. As it says, the tables are now turned, completely turned round now. The victims now become the victors. The inability of their enemies to harm them and the people's fear of them could only partly be explained by the fact that the king was now obviously on the side of the Jews. He made it quite clear. And also, of course, the people in authority now were on the side of the Jews, because they wanted to ingratiate themselves with Mordecai, because now he was their boss now, you see. And so they wanted to maintain their positions throughout the empire. But this, in the word, and as you go through it, you can see the hand of God behind it. They would also be afraid, well, this is the Jewish God who's done this for them. And so they could see beyond this, you see. Now, verses 5 to 16. The Jews struck down all their enemies with a sword, killing and destroying them, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them. In the citadel of Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. They also killed Barshanda, Dalphon, Aspatha, Poratha, Adelia, Aridia, Parmasha, and the rest of them there. And also notice the 10 sons of Haman, son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. But they did not lay their hands on their plunder. They were given permission to do this, but they didn't do it. The number of those slain in the citadel of Susa was reported to the king that same day. The king said to the queen Esther, "The Jews have killed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman in the city of Susa. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is your petition? It will be given to you. Whatever is your request, it will be given to you. It will be granted." "If it pleases the king," Esther answered, "give the Jews in Susa permission to carry out this day's edict tomorrow also, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows." So the king commanded that this be done, and the edict was issued in Susa, and they hanged the 10 sons of Haman. The Jews in Susa came together on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they put to death in Susa 300 men. They did not lay their hands on their plunder. Meanwhile, the remainder of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also assembled to protect themselves and get relief from their enemies. They killed 75,000 of them, but they did not lay their hands on the plunder. This happened on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. Now, the Jews were not only successful in defending themselves, but they also attacked and killed those enemies who would, if they were given the chance, would have killed the Jews. They struck first. They were given permission to arm this. Normally, they wouldn't have been allowed to have arms or anything, but the king had specifically given them permission, so they're able now to defend themselves. Now, the killing of Haman's sons is particularly mentioned, as this would prevent any chance of them seeking revenge afterwards, you see. Because it was a custom amongst those that they would, if you killed one of those, they must seek revenge, you see. Particular emphasis is laid on the fact that after killing their enemies, they didn't plunder the families. Now, this is most important. This demonstrated to everybody, and everybody took note of it, that they were only protecting themselves. There was no other ulterior motive. They weren't trying to dominate the rest of the people. They were demonstrating to everybody, all we're doing, we're not trying to take over, we're not trying to become more powerful than anybody else. We're just protecting ourselves. So they deliberately did not take any of the plunder. Now verses 18 to 32. The Jews in Susa, however, had assembled on the 13th and 14th day, and then on the 15th day they rested, and they made it a day of feasting and joy. That is why rural Jews, those living in villages, observed the 14th of the month of Adar as a day of joy and feasting, a day for giving presents to each other. Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes, near and far, to have them celebrate annually the 14th and 15th day of the month of Adar, as the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month when their sorrows were turned into joy, and their mourning into day of celebration. He wrote to them to observe the days as days of feasting and joy, and giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews agreed to continue the celebration they had begun, doing what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and cast a pur, that's the lot, for their ruin and destruction. But when the clock came to the king's attention, he issued written orders, and the evil scheme Haman had devised against the Jews should come back on its own head, and he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore, these days were called Purim, from the word pure, P-U-R, because of everyone written in this letter and because of what they had seen. And when that happened to them, the Jews took it upon themselves to establish the custom that they and their descendants and all who joined them should without fail observe these 2 days, every year in the way prescribed and at the time appointed. These days should be remembered and observed in every generation, by every family, and in every province, and in every city. And these days, the Purim, should never cease to be celebrated by the Jews, nor should the memory of them die out among their descendants. So Queen Esther, daughter of Abihail, along with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter concerning Purim. And Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews in the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Xerxes, words of goodwill and assurance, to establish these days of Purim at their designated time, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had decreed for them. And so they had established for themselves and their descendants in regard to their times of feasting and lamentation. Esther's decree confirmed these regulations about Purim, and it was written down in the records. There was now great rejoicing throughout the land at the way they'd been miraculously delivered from annihilation. They all agreed that this day, the 13th day of the month of Adar, exactly a month before Passover, should always be remembered by all their descendants with feasting and celebration, thanks to God for their deliverance, so that no Jew would ever forget how God is in control of the nation of the Jews and he has a future for them, that they would never ever be exterminated. The Feast of Purim has always, right up to the present day, held a special place for the Jews. It always reminded them that even in their darkest hours throughout the ages, when it seemed there was no hope for them, their God would never let them be destroyed, whatever the forces arranged against them. You see, this was what they do. They have this feast, they have it now, every year, a month before. It's not one of the Lord's feasts, it's one that they put in themselves. And during this feast, they have a great rejoicing, as they say here, and they always read through the book of Esther at this feast. And that's been carried on right through the ages. That's 2,400 years or so now. And that's where it comes from, you see. Now, it's interesting that they're in the same position today as they were all those years ago. Now, think of it. The Jewish nation, and they've imagined, this has been like this throughout history, but never so much today. There's that tiny little, if you look on the map, the tiny little bit of Israel there. And they've got all these masses of Muslim nations around, Islam around them. You have a look on the map there, you can see them all. It's a massive, all the huge state, and there they've got a tiny little Israel. And they've sworn that they were going to destroy Israel. And the 6 Days War was a vivid example. It was really a rerun of Esther. If you read through it, it's fascinating to read the story of it. They were going to wipe them all out. They all got together, and they were going to wipe them out before they really got established. But what happened? Exactly the same, the tables were turned. You remember how the Egyptian Air Force was destroyed on the ground before it could take off, and exactly opposite. Israel would have run right into Egypt if they hadn't been stopped by the United Nations. They pushed right the way through onto the Nile, and they were crossing the Nile there. The Jordan was pushed right back out there. They took over Jerusalem, which hadn't been theirs, so they took it over completely, and up in Syria, they pushed them back on the Golan Heights. Exactly. It seemed impossible. You imagine, they were heavily outnumbered, enormously outnumbered, not only by men, but by planes and everything. But they did it. Exactly the same. This was a rerun of Esther. And this is what it is, you see. It shows how God is in complete control. But the thing to see from all this is it's the same right through history. They were still trying to destroy the Jews. All those years ago, it's happening today. It's not going to be. There's going to be another later on. We're not going to be here to see it. When another attempt to destroy the Jews is going to take place in the Great Tribulation. And this is what's called the time of Jacob's trouble. That's after Christians have been taken out. We won't be there. And they will almost look as though they're going to completely destroy them. But that's when God comes back, when Jesus comes back. And we read this, you know, we've got this in John, we've got it in several places here, how Jesus will come back. And at that point, then that will be the things will be wrapped up. And the Jews will inherit the land as God intended. Not the tiny little bit now they've got, but the entire area that God said, which, remember, stretched from the Euphrates right the way down as far as Egypt. The whole area, they're going to get that. And that will be in the 1,000 years there. But that's a story in its own. We'll continue with that later. But remember this. The one thing to remember out of Esther is that God is in complete control. He will never let his people be destroyed. Doesn't matter what they do, it's the promise that's given to them. Remember, it was a one-sided promise given Abraham all the 4,000 years ago. it wasn't a double promise, not if you will. No, it was the promise was given. Whatever happens, they would never be destroyed. Mm. And that's going to carry on through. So look at history now. See what's happening out there now. Mm. And you're seeing it unfolding. We're living in marvellous times, you know.
Yes.
We're watching, see what's happening around us now. When you see what's, and you see how God is moving nations. You see how he used Cyrus, Darius, and this is Artaxerxes. Later on, coming on, this actually is Xerxes here we're dealing with in Esther, but later on we'll see with Artaxerxes how he's using them, and he's doing exactly the same with the nations around us. He's using USA, Bush, he's using the British Empire, he's using the Australians, using all these, they're just pawns that God's using at the time. Don't think that they're in control. God is in complete control of everything. And as he's in control of the nations, he's in control of our lives as well, individually. We sometimes forget this.
Yes,
you look back on your life and you see how God has controlled you. I don't know, sometimes I look back and I'm horrified. But God has been in control all the way through.
Definitely.
If we're his children, he's in control. We have also...
Yes, and
notice how what he said to Esther, if you don't do this, I'll move somebody else.
It's
same with us. If we don't obey, God will, but we'll lose. I mean, think of it when you get before the time when we appear before the Lord. He says, look, I want you to do this, and you didn't do it.
Yeah.
How ashamed we're going to feel at that time. We've got the opportunities. He will use us. King Xerxes imposed tribute throughout the empire to its distant shores, and all his acts of power and might, together with a full account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king had raised him, are they not written in the books of the annals of the kings of Media and Persia? Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, and held in high esteem by his many fellow Jews, because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. The book of Esther ends with how Mordecai, a Jew in a foreign country, was looked up to and honoured by all the people, because of his honesty and sincerity, of the witness of his life before everyone. This is I think this is how we should appear with our contact with the world. Is a terrific example to us. We should be such a witness. The people, they should look at them. These Christians, they're honest and they don't lie, they don't cheat. And you'll find the world would look up to you if you're like this. Now, following on from this, because of this, you can see how much the Jews were in the land were honoured. And the fact, you see, they didn't take anything. Remembering back, they didn't take any of the plunder or anything.
No.
They were honest people, and they were held in very high esteem throughout. And this is what Christians should be in any nation.
Definitely.
But are they?
No.
But it's an example to us. This is how we should be. And that's how we finish up with the book of Esther.
No.
But it sets the scene now for the rest of the time. And you can understand now why the next king, Artaxerxes, was so sympathetic to the Jews, because they took this example of Mordecai. And we can do the same, you see. You'll find that the nation, though there may be heathen nations, they would still listen to Christians if they showed the example.
Exactly.
But if Christians turn around and they see they're always squabbling amongst each other, they're always lying and cheating, nobody will take any notice. But I've found this in my own work, and I've seen with other people, and other people told me the same way. If you're a Christian, they may not agree with you, they may be a bit embarrassed by you, but if you say a thing, well, I've heard it said, well, if Stan says it, it must be right, because he doesn't lie. And that's the kind of thing it should be. Right, now then, we're going back now to Ezra. Now, Ezra chapter 7 now. Now remember, we're now moving on to the end of the 58 years of silence in the book of Ezra, and we now meet the man from whom the whole book has taken its name. Remember, before this, it was Ezra had collected the history. It wasn't him there. He just collected. It's called Ezra. But from now we're actually going to meet him. This is actually him himself. This chapter and the next will introduce us to the scholar, the priest Ezra. His task and his expedition, The remaining two chapters will show the moral disarray which he encountered at Jerusalem and the unsparing countermeasures he applied. Much of the account in this record uses I and we, the personal account, to show it was him recording it. It's assumed that it was Ezra who wrote this. We can't be sure about this. Now, chapter 7, verses 1 to 10. After these things, during the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra, son of Seraiah, the son of Azariah, the son of Hilkiah, the son of Shallum, the son of Zadok, the son of Hattim, the son of Amariah, the son of Azariah, the son of Meriah, the son of Zerahah, the son of Azar, the son of Buka, the son of Aaron, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron. So he's all leading up to that point. The chief priest. This Ezra came up from Babylon. He was a teacher, well versed in the law of Moses, which the Lord, the God of Israel, had given. The king had granted him everything he asked for the hand of the Lord his God was with him. Some of the Israelites, including priests, Levites, singers, gatekeepers, and temple servants, also came up to Jerusalem in the seventh year of King Artaxerxes. Ezra arrived in Jerusalem in the fifth month of the seventh year of the king. He had begun his journey from Babylon on the first day of the first month. So it took him 4 months altogether. And he arrived in Jerusalem the first day of the fifth month. For the good hand of his God was on him. For Ezra had devoted himself to the study and observation of the law of the Lord and to teaching his decrees and laws in Israel. Now these verses here are a summary of what follows in chapter 8. It's all been summarised here. The after these things means after the events for the previous chapter, which was 58 years. See, there's a 58-year gap, and now we're picking up the story again. We then get the genealogy of Ezra, showing that he was a descendant of Aaron. That's the purpose of putting it there, you see. Hence his right to be a priest. He was of the priest. It then describes him as a teacher with a sound knowledge and understanding of God's law as revealed through Moses. And because of his devotion in not only the study but also the practice in his own life of God's law and will, God's hand was upon him because he practiced what he preached. Yes, and it was obvious to everyone. He didn't just know it. He was teaching that which he really knew. He was able to speak and teach with authority because he knew God's word thoroughly. And what an example to us. How many preachers do we hear who really don't know God's word thoroughly? In these verses, we learn and understand why Ezra had had such a lasting influence, not only in his time, but also in Jewish belief down through the ages, as a second to Moses. He's always considered second to Moses. He was more than any other man, was the one who stamped Israel as being the people of the book, the people of God's word. He stamped this upon them, that they're the people, and this has been recognized right the way down to the present age. He taught what he had first lived, and what he lived, he first made sure, was as God showed him in the scriptures. We had a tremendous example of here how we should live. People of the book. People who really know God's word, the Bible, but not only know God's word, but live by it. It's no good knowing it unless you put it into practice. It's dead otherwise. But he was a supreme example of this. Now verses 11 to 26. We'll go right through that bit there. This is a copy of the letter King Artaxerxes had given to Ezra the priest and teacher, a man learned in matters concerning the commands and decrees of the Lord for Israel. Artaxerxes, King of Kings, to Ezra the priest, a teacher of the law of the God of heaven. Greetings, first of all. Now I decree that any of the Israelites in my kingdom, including priests and Levites, who wish to go to Jerusalem with you, may go. You are sent by the king and his seven advisers to inquire about Judah and Jerusalem with regard to the law of your God, which is in your hand. Moreover, you are to take with you the silver and gold that the king and his advisers have freely given to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem, together with all the silver and gold you may obtain from the provinces of Babylon, as well as the freewill offering of the people and priests for the temple of their God in Jerusalem. With this money, be sure to buy bulls, rams, and male lambs, together with their grain offerings and drink offerings, and sacrifice them on the altar of the temple of your God in Jerusalem. You and your brother Jews may then do whatever seems best with the rest of the silver and gold, in accordance with the will of your God. Deliver to the God of Jerusalem all the articles entrusted to you for worship in the temple of your God, and anything else needed for the temple of your God that you may have occasion to supply. You may provide from the royal treasury. Now I, King Artaxerxes, order all the treasurers of Trans-Euphrates to provide with diligence whatever Ezra the priest, a teacher of the law of the God of heaven, may ask of you, up to 100 cores of wheat, 100 baths of wine, 100 baths of olive oil, and salt without limit. Whatever the God of heaven has prescribed, let it be done with diligence for the temple of the God of heaven. Why should there be wrath against the realm of the king and his sons? You are also to know that you have no authority to impose taxes, tribute, or duty on any of the priests, Levites, singers, gatekeepers, temple servants, or other workers at this outer God. And you, Ezra, in accordance with the wisdom of your God, which you possess, appoint magistrates and judges to administer justice to all the people of Trans-Euphrates, all who know the laws of your God, and you are to teach any who do not know them. Whoever does not obey the law of your God and the law of the king must surely be punished by death, banishment, confiscation of property, or imprisonment. This letter of authority from the king clearly shows Ezra's guidance in its composition. He must have been behind it. Mm. You see now, Artaxerxes now is the king after Xerxes. It also shows how Ezra was held in such high regard and trust by the king. He was given tremendous power and privileges to make sure that he could do his job of sorting out the mess the people had got themselves into. Notice particularly verse 25, the king's comments, which you possess. It was obvious to everybody, and even the pagan king had to acknowledge it. Again, what an example to us. Now, in this, you might say, well, why is the king doing this? From a human point of view, he wanted to ingratiate himself with the God of the Jews, because he'd seen, he'd known what it must be a powerful God. It was happening previously with my father, with Esther and that. So he wanted to ingratiate himself with the king. And you see how, so that the wrath of God shouldn't be of your God, notice, amongst all his other gods, but of your God. But behind all this is the hand of God, you see. As Christians, we see how God again was raising up somebody else, Artaxerxes, who would now use Ezra, the king Artaxerxes, so Ezra would have the authority to go back and sort out the mess that they got themselves into. Verses 27-28. And this is Ezra now speaking. Praise be to the Lord, the God of our fathers, who has put into the king's heart to bring honour to the house of the Lord in Jerusalem this way, and who has extended his good favour to me before the king and his advisers and all the king's powerful officials, because the hand of the Lord my God was on me. I took courage and gathered together leading men from Israel to go up with me. Now this is the secret of Ezra's success. He gave all the honour and praise to God. It's not because I was good, I was that. No, it says because God was in control. Mm-hmm. And this is what our secret is. If we do anything, if it's done from ourselves, this is what we call, this is the tear, the things are going to all get burnt up, nothing there at all, the hay, the straw. But it's the things that come from God. We give God the praise, God will use us. Never exalt ourselves. And it also gave him, realizing this, it gave him the tremendous courage to do this. It was a tremendous task he was going to do this, what he was going to do. Now we come on to chapter 8. These are the family heads of those registered with him who came up with me from Babylon during the reign of King Artaxerxes. And it gives all the list of them here, down here. Notice the words "with me." In this chapter, right up to verse 34, it is personal reporting. And this personal reporting continues again throughout chapter 9. From verse 2 to 14, the long list of names shows that in every case, except for one, the Levites, these groups are at long last, 78 years after the first return from captivity, they're joining in the groups there. This is 78 years afterwards, 8 years after the, it's 78 years now, so it's 58 years after the temple had been completed. The first lot went back 78 years before, and now the families are joining, this would be the descendants of both sides, are going back to Jerusalem. But amongst them, there are no Levites, and we'll see the reason for this in a minute. Now, verses 15 to 20. I assembled them at the canal that flows through Ahavia, and we camped there 3 days. When I checked amongst the people and the priests, I found no Levites there. So I summoned Eleazar, and he gives the list of the people who were leaders, and Joab, and who were men of learning, and I sent them to Iddo, the leader in Casiphia, and told them what to say to Ida and his kinsmen, and temple servants in Casiphia, so that they might bring attendance to us from the house of our God. Because the good hand of our God was on us, they brought us Sherebiah, a capable man, from the descendants of Mahal, son of Levi, the son of Israel, and Sherebiah's sons and brothers, 18 men, and Hashbeshah, together with Jehau, from the descendants of Merah, and his brothers and nephews, 20 men. They also brought 220 of the temple servants, a body that David and the officials had established to assist the Levites. All were registered by name. Notice how they kept the records all the way, which was most important. Now the 3-day pause, they're all ready to go back, you see. They gathered together, all those are going back now. The 3-day pause at the canal was to take stock and check up everything, including who were with them. They wanted to, before they set out on this long journey, it was nearly 1,000 miles, they wanted to check who they got. They then discover the absence of the Levites and other temple servants. The probable reason for this was that they shrank from the prospect that lay before them. Not only the uprooting from their settled way of life in the Babylonia, they were nicely settled down here, got all their families and everything settled down there, but also the drastic change in their life they would face if, you see, if they went back, what the idea, they wanted them back in the temple so that they will be able to do the official things in the temple. And if you read back previously, we know that it was a very arduous thing they were having to do. They were going to have to devote themselves to the work of the temple, and they shrank from this. Look, we're nicely settled out here in Babylonia area. Well, why should we go back to do all this? And it's quite reasonable when you think of it. Now, Ezra very carefully chooses 9 emissaries who were respected leaders, including men of learning and those with diplomatic skills, to persuade them to join them. Notice how in verse 17, Ezra gives them clear instructions as to who to approach and what to say to them. These are the ones he particularly wants, you see. In verse 18, we see the outcome was very successful, not only in the numbers, but in the provision of gifted leaders. There was Sherebiah, and the people they'd chosen were the right ones, the ones that were going to be the most value to them. But as ever, Ezra gives all the praise to God. It's because God's hand, not because I was clever in choosing people to go and speak to them, but because God was in control. Notice again and again, Ezra always gives the praise to God. I think it's a lovely lesson to us. Now verses 21 to 24. There by the Ahava canal I proclaimed a fast, so we might humble ourselves before our God and ask him for a safe journey for us and our children with all our possessions. And then notice this. I was ashamed to ask the king for soldiers and horsemen to protect us from enemies on the road, because we told the king, the good hand of our God is on everyone who looks up to him, but his great anger is against all who forsake him. So we fasted and petitioned our God about this, and he answered our prayers. See, they were now faced with a long and dangerous journey. It was nearly 1,000 miles. Walking, remember, all the way. And it could be a very dangerous country they were passing through. There would be all bandits and all kinds of people, because although it was the king's empire, no country is ever secure. There'd be all that with these people there. But having told the king that their God was all-powerful and would always take care of them, they were faced with a difficult choice when the king offered to send an armed guard with them to protect them on the journey. What are we going to do? We've told the king that God's going to look after us. And now the king's going to offer us all these people to come with us. It's going to be a bit of a about-face, isn't it? But before they made any decision, notice what they did. They first fasted, and then they prayed to God. Lord, what shall we do? We're in a bit of a pickle here. And he said that God told them, in this particular case, they were to trust him alone for their saviour. In this particular case. Now, Christians often have to face this type of decision. And God expects us to use our common sense and not put ourselves in unnecessary danger. But if we are in doubt, we always ask God. Now, you get people to say, oh, I'm not worried about going through this dark, dangerous place. God's going to look after me. Now, that's stupid. You don't put yourself in stupid positions, but you ask. It may be that God wants you to do this, and he says, but ask first. Be very sure about this. But Christian, and then when anything happens, see, if they don't do this and anything happens to them, oh my God, failed me. That's stupid. You failed yourself. You put yourself in that situation. Exactly. Use common sense there. But this is often, I've said it so many times, come up this. Oh, it's interesting to note, by the way, later on we're reading Nehemiah. Nehemiah was given the same choice when he went, but he chose to take the king's soldiers because this situation was different, you see. He again would have asked God. They're both men of faith. But two different conditions, you see. But this time, God wanted to show them and clearly show to them that he was protecting them. That was a specific case. But never use this as an example. Some people have used this as an example and say, well, this is what we should be like. No. Use your common sense. Verses 24 to 30. Then I set apart 12 of the leading priests, together with Sherebiah, Hashmiah, and 10 of their brothers, and I weighed out to them the offering of silver and gold, and the articles of the king and his advisers, his officials, and all Israel present there, had donated for the house of God. I weighed out to them 650 talents of silver, silver articles weighing 100 talents, 100 talents of gold, 20 bowls of gold valued at 1,000 darius, and 2 fine articles of polished bronze, as precious as gold. I told to them, you, as well as these articles, are consecrated to the Lord. The silver and gold are a freewill offering to the Lord, the God of your fathers. Guard them carefully until you weigh them out in the chambers of the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, before the leading priests and Levites and the family heads of Israel. Then the priests and Levites received the silver and gold and sacred articles that had been weighed out to them to be taken to the house of God in Jerusalem. Now we see here how the treasure entrusted to them on the journey was enormous. And Ezra's refusal to have an armed guard and his reminder to the priests of their sacred trust gave them an abrupt initiation into the discipline of faith and trust in God. So this is what God wanted to show them. This would have been a tremendous temptation for bandits of that. He made it on this journey to attack them. But God had said he was going to, in this particular case, he was going to protect them. And so the priests, Ezra now turns to the priests and said, right, now you've got to put your trust in God. You're in charge of them. They're all under your care now. If anything happens to them, you're answerable. You put your trust in God now that he will protect you. So it was quite a lesson to them, you see. Now verse 31-32. On the 12th day of the first month, we set out from the Harvard Canal to go to Jerusalem. The hand of our God was on us, and he protected us from enemies and bandits along the way. So we arrived in Jerusalem, where we rested 3 days. Now imagine, this was how many months? 3-4 months it had taken them. 4 months, I think it was. And this tremendous journey, nearly 1,000 miles, and it's all dismissed in just those few verses. The only thing he's pointed out, he didn't talk about all the trials and tribulations they must have had on the way there. The only thing he pointed out was, God was in charge. He protected us all the way. And that was the important thing there all the way through, you see. God was looking after us. Mm-hmm. You could have made a lot of that, couldn't you? You could have spoken for hours on this. You could have written for hours on this, how God had looked after them, how they'd gone through all the different places. But he just said, God was in charge. Mm-hmm. So the journey didn't really matter. And then verse 33-34. On the fourth day in the house of our God, we weighed out the silver and gold and the sacred articles into the hands of Amareth, son of Uriah the priest. Eleazar, son of Phinehas, was with him. And so were the Levites, Jozabad, son of Jeshua, and Nodiah, son of Benaiah. Everything was accounted for by number and weight, and the entire weight was recorded at that time. The procedure now is very businesslike and orderly. And the statement made there, despite the long journey and hazardous journey, nothing was missing, indicating that God's hand was upon them all the way. The whole lot was there. There was nothing missing after this long journey. And then the last few verses, 35-36, then the exiles who had returned from captivity sacrificed burnt offerings to the God of Israel, 12 bulls for all Israel, 96 rams, 77 male lambs as a sin offering, 12 male goats. All this was a burnt offering to the Lord. They also delivered the king's orders to the royal satraps and to the governors of Trans-Euphrates, who then gave assistance to the people and to the house of God. The first thing they did was to give thanks to God with the burnt offerings, and then gave the king's orders to all the governors and kings representing the land. And that's what we should do, really, isn't it? When any journey or anything, when God has helped, we say, thank you, Lord, get together and give thanks.